The great days of radio brought us a masked man who wore a black mask and had a silver horse, and also a man who wore a silver mask and used some black tires as transportation. Talk about Joseph White, who was known as a silver mask tenor during the earliest of the radio days. We're having a wonderful opportunity to chat with his son, who also contributed a lot to the radio days. We're visiting with Robert White, and we're so happy to be here, Robert.
It's a delight to have you both here, really.
Thank you very much. Now, tell us a little bit about your father and how he got that name, the Silver Mask Tenor.
He was a singer, a mm-hmm. tenor, of course, who had come back from the First World War, had already recorded both for Thomas Edison and for Columbia Records mm-hmm. as Joseph Malachy White. And then he got into radio when it was just off the oatmeal box and the cat's whiskers were turned into mm-hmm. dials, and Dad was right in there. Around 22, if memory serves, he started at WJZ in New Jersey, and Tommy Cowan was his first announcer, and Dad always said how Tommy sat in a wicker chair and said, "Go ahead, Joe," and pointed to him, and whatever, they were on the air. By 24, he was one of the very first big sponsored programs where he became the singer with an orchestra that was called the B.F. Goodrich Silvertown Chord Orchestra. Their sponsor was obviously B.F. Goodrich Rubber and Tire mm-hmm. Company. And their top-of-the-line tire were called the Silvertown Chords. Mm-hmm. So the orchestra had that name, and the announcer for that series was Phillips Carlin. By the way, Tommy Cowan, that announcer I mentioned first, mm-hmm. who went on to do lots of stuff here in New York on WNYC, was my godfather. My brother Philip was the godson of Dad's then announcer, Phillips Carlin, who was the one that announced to the radio audience very early on in the series with the B.F. Goodrich Orchestra that the tenor you heard is a man of mystery. And he made a play on the fact that the Dumas classic was on in the movies at that time. Was it with Paul Muni or someone like that, The Man in the Iron Mask? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Whatever the silent mm-hmm. version yeah, of that yeah. was. And he said he's a man of mystery. He is the tenor in the silver mask. All the instruments are made of silver here with the Silvertown Chord Orchestra. He was just carrying on. Mm-hmm. God knows what they were on in those days. And so they laughed at it, except mm-hmm. they got thousands of letters from Radioland, which was already proliferating like mm-hmm. crazy in 1924, who is the silver mask tenor, who is the man of the silver mask. So they thought it was a good publicity stunt, and they got him a silver plated mask, and it got so big, the fame and the whole mm-hmm. Rapture on the part of the audiences, that they finally sprung for a sterling silver one, which I don't know where it is. It's gone years and years ago.
Anticipating my next question.
You yeah. see?
He had been on the program for a while before they billed him as the silver mask tenor.
Right, but
no credit given.
No credit given. Mm-hmm. And then they did that, and that started it for 5 years. He was a mystery man, the silver mask tenor.
Now, he was doing other things at the same time under his own name?
Not really. Once that silver mask got given to him, mm-hmm. he went for it. I mean, years later, one might say, oh, why did he do it? But it's such a moment of wonderment, I think, in early radio, you know, when furniture, as Fred Allen used to say, began to talk, that there'd be the mystery of a man with a silver mask. You couldn't see him anyway. It wasn't television. But people loved the idea, and they guessed, was he Franklin Burr? Was he John McCormick? Was he this one or that, you know? And that's how
was
that
he
started.
Was he ultimately exposed for who he was then
yes,
on that program?
Yes, and I remember there's one critic wrote in a kind of tongue-in-cheek and a little bit of a dig way, well, we've all, now the mystery is solved and he's Joe White. And it was almost probably by then in 1930, I think, when that happened, mm-hmm. right after the crash of Wall Street, that whole phantasmagorical era was finished. The 20s mm-hmm. were gone. Mm-hmm. It was maybe an afterbang, you know? But then he went on to sing for all the rest of those years of his singing career as Joe White, the Silver Mask Tenor.
Oh, yeah. he still he continued
used,
yeah, with
he
that.
Yeah, he didn't wear it, but he used mm-hmm. the name.
And he went on, he did lots of recordings.
Well, he had done the recordings, mm-hmm. most of them, in that five-year period in the 20s for Victor. He was a Victor recording artist with Joseph Connect conducting the B.F. Goodrich Silvertown Chord Orchestra, and he did beautiful ballads such as Kathleen Mavourneen and The Harp That Went Through Tara's Halls and Dream Kisses and things like that, but tons of foxtrots of the day, you know, mm-hmm. Silver songbirds sing to me, your brown eyes, why are you blue? And if all the stars were pretty babies and I were the man in the moon. And it always came out with an Irish accent. Uh-huh. I would jump up and kiss every heavenly miss and make love like a son of Argonne.
Well, tenors were very, very popular, very big back
they
at
were
that
the big,
period.
The right? big guys in those days, you're right.
So he continued to sing then for the rest of his life?
Sang for the rest of his life. I started on the radio then in a scant 20 years later, which is mm-hmm. amazing because I look back at my own life and I realize, you know, what the hell are 20 years? Nothing, right? But mm-hmm. it was mm-hmm. 20 years later when I started and his career was already over. Radio had progressed to this incredible medium that it mm-hmm. was by the late 30s and the early 40s. Mm-hmm. The war was on and I was on a show that my brothers and sisters before me had already been on, a children's hour, on the same WJZ, the Blue Network, they called it by the early 40s, mm-hmm. when they split EAF, WEAF, or the Red Network and the Blue.
Yes.
We were on every Sunday morning. We got $5 a week to sing. There were about 40 of us kids. It was a wonderful show. Milton Cross was the announcer, and it was called Coast to Coast on a Bus. And it's really where I learned what it was like to get in front of a microphone.
Now, you were singing on that program, and you had dialogue, you were acting as well.
Yes. You'd stand up in three boxes and say, gee, Mr. Cross, or gee, Mr. Cross. You know, and he'd say something to me like, such as, well, little Bobby White, are you going to sing another John McCormick song or something your father, Joe White, the Silver Mass tenor, has written? I mean, that was, you know, I had a mm-hmm. dance, the good dance in those days.
But there was no dramatic scenes or anything other
than
that.
Some of the times, yeah. But I wasn't in on them so mm-hmm. much. I mm-hmm. was in on talking with him from a script. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. I still have some of those scripts from Coast to Coast on a Bus.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then what happened, by 46, I remember I got on a show called Ladies Be Seated that Johnny...
Olson?
Yes.
Johnny Olson.
Johnny
that.
Olson, mm-hmm. very good, wow. Johnny Olson was on that. He was a good friend of Dad's. And I think that's the first show that I might have a recording of. No, I have some from 1945. We lost the recording from the very first show in 1943, Easter Sunday, because it was on glass. Mm-hmm. It was mm-hmm. the war, and so the acetates were not on metal.
Yes, uh-huh.
And that, of course, just broke into smithereens. End of story. But I did... Johnny Olson's show, I remember, and then I got on Tex and Jinx. They had a show called High Jinx, the Tex and Jinx show. It was Jinx Falkenberg and Tex McCurry on NBC mm-hmm. in the mornings. Mm-hmm. And by 1946 or so, I remember I sang on that sometimes, interviewed on it. Then I got on the television in 46 or maybe early 47, but I think it was late 46. On Dumont, down at the John Wanamaker Studios, which was the department store mm-hmm. in 8th Street mm-hmm. in the Village. And Irene Wicker, the singing lady, had me on her show. She was a great friend of my dad, again, because her husband was Victor Hammer of the Hammer Galleries, and his brother was Armand Hammer of Occidental Petroleum. And they were all good buddies to my dad, I remember, and I got on the show. And that was my first television. And then I went on from there and did WFIL, the Paul Whiteman show from Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. It was on television around 47, I guess. And also, the big break for me was when Fred Allen took me on to his show for the St. Patrick's Night of 1947.
His radio show.
His radio mm-hmm. show, the big Sunday night show. Paid me $500. Oh, and subsequently, the many other times I was on it, I got $500 mm-hmm. bucks each time, which astonished me. Once I was terribly disappointed. I only got $250, I remember. Imagine what that money was in those days.
Oh, my, yeah.
Because I didn't sing on one of the shows. I only acted. He often had me act and sing. But I only acted, and that was a show with Humphrey Bogart as the guest. And in the skit with Humphrey, Fred had me play the part of a scoutmaster, the Boy Scout troop. And my Boy Scout was Humphrey Bogart. So you can imagine the turning of those tables where I was giving orders
you're doing the,
to Humphrey.
And the bogey voice,
yes,
so-called.
Yes, I was bossing him around. But when the check came, I expected the 500, right? But instead it was 250. And I was highly disappointed in the South Bronx.
How did you get on the Fred Allen Show? How did it, you come
Fred
to his attention?
Fred and Dad were great friends.
Oh, I see.
And Dad, just before I started on Coast to Coast, the change in family fortunes occurred in a terrible way. Pop was just beginning to make a comeback. He was singing on a radio show out of NBC called Bill's Gay 90s, because there's still a restaurant called the Bill's Gay 90s on 54th Street. And that fellow, whoever Bill was, had this radio show in on the sixth floor of NBC. I remember the studio, and there was like an orchestra, and Pop was a guest. And I remember going where he stuck his head out of a curtain to greet the audience. This was in 43, early 43, very late 42. Looking like the Artful Dodger, you know. Mm-hmm. Well, anyway, Dad was going to get some music for that show, and he went to Shapiro Bernstein Publishers offices in the what was then called the RKO building, which is the part of Rockefeller Center that still houses Radio City Music Hall. And Shapiro was, Elliot Shapiro was his good friend. He walked into the office in April of 43, and they had just waxed the floors, and it was soaking wet with wax and no signs or anything. Poor Pop slipped, broke the leg in two places.
Oh, boy.
They amputated the leg.
Oh, my.
So all of a sudden, I was on the air to earn money, the family, because in those days, there was no cushion, you know. So his income stopped and mine started at $5 a week. But then I got on, as I said, these other shows. And by 46, 47, I was doing all of these wonderful programs, especially Fred Allen. And I was really the breadwinner then for those years and on up to 1950.
It was kind of fashionable in those days to have youngsters with incredible talent appear on radio programs. Eddie Cantor, for example, had Bobby Breen and Deanna Durbin, and other programs too had youngsters who would be. So Fred Allen,
I was the logical one for Fred. He knew Pop very well, and he certainly knew that it would not hurt our family to have Bobby working, and that's what happened.
So what kind of music would you perform when you were on the Allen Show?
Always the big ballads more than anything. A few times I sang with the DeMarco sisters as well. They always had their spot to sing. Of course, they were the weekly group, and they were darling, wonderful gals. I loved them like they were my ultimate big sisters in those days. But one of the Christmas shows of 47, I sang Deck the Halls and First Noel with the DeMarco sisters, and they would go bung 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 bung, but deck the halls, you know. And I go fa la 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 la. I've got to get that recording. Oh ye in Radio Land, whoever has it, give me a yell.
Try to track them down. For
yeah, they do exist, you know. Another time with, I think the night I might have been on with Will Jordan, where I didn't speak a word. I sang though. I think that was the night that the song I sang was a little bit more updated from Irish balladdom, and it was "Dear One, the World is Waiting for the Sunrise," you know, with the girls going "Ooh" behind me. So I felt very Pop in those days doing that. And then I did lots of other shows, "We the People," with Dwight Wiest for Gulf Oil, and Pop was interviewed on that, and I sang "Our Sweet Mystery of Life." I did tons of acting shows, the soap operas. I was Dickie on Portia Faces Life with, if I remember, it was Lucille Wall, I think was Portia, or she was, yes, because I did the Aunt Jenny show with Dan Seymour announcing in the old days.
Oh, yes.
And I don't remember whether Lucille Wall was Julie Paterno on Aunt Jenny. Ye out there in Radio Land, somebody probably knows the answer to that.
Lucille Wall also was Lorenzo Jones' wife.
Oh, really? I didn't
but
know
they
that.
Did. They had, you know, they would do many.
She was a very nice lady. Rosa Rio
the
used
organist.
To play organ on any number of those shows. Lou White was another organist, and another guy named Bill Wirges, W-I-R-G-E-S. They were great friends of my dad. And I loved them all, and they played the organ, and they had the solo vox mm-hmm. attachments and the celeste and the piano. And for me, it was heavenly. I felt very safe in those studios, very happy. And I loved the fact that I was earning a living whenever I was doing a show.
Well, how busy were you at that time?
Very. I was busy. In grammar school at St. Jerome's in the Bronx. Mm-hmm. Thank God I was a bright student. And the nuns seemed to think it was a great idea that I didn't go to school, you know, except when I wanted to. Well, I took as much advantage of that as I could. But because I was hanging out with a lot of grown-ups, I sailed through grammar school in 6 years instead of eight. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. I skipped. And then I went into high school. And my voice never cracked. It never changed abruptly. It went nicely and smoothly through my adolescence down into a baritonal range, and then worked its way back up into mm-hmm. the tenor that I became. I had a very interesting whole series of things as a career would be after radio, because I had my own television show in 1950 on here in the New York station for the Daily News, the newspaper. It was called WPIX. Mm-hmm. And my show was called Shamrock Time, appropriately enough. And I'd sing Irish songs. And I did the first television show that Joe Franklin ever did, because he was a great friend of Dad, and I used to remember Joe when he was only on the radio mm-hmm. before he mm-hmm. ventured into television. And then...
You did something with Lanny Ross, too, didn't you?
Thank you for reminding me of that. Yes, I had a 3 times a week stint for a couple of seasons. I can't quite remember. I do know it's probably 48 and 49 at WOR Radio, 1440 Broadway, around 41st Street. Daytime, around 12 or 1-ish in the day, 3 times a week, I was Lanny's sidekick guest. It was a wonderful show. Lanny was such a gentleman. Very proper guy, and mm-hmm. it was from Yale, and singing. He always had a lovely voice, and we'd do nice things. I'd do solos, we'd do some duets. Quanta la gusta, la gusta, la gusta. I remember doing that, and Oh Mr. Gallagher, Oh Mr. Gallagher.
Gallagher and Sheen?
Gallagher and Sheen, uh-huh. Lanny and me playing mm-hmm. off each other. That was an adorable show. I started to make some records.
Well, with all of this, you're doing all this radio work, and you're sailing through school, which was very nice. What about any formal musical training?
Good question. Mm-hmm. I didn't get any yet. I was absorbing. I took my mother gave me. We lived in the South Irish Bronx in those days on Alexander Avenue, and there was a Mrs. Green and a Mrs. Green and a Miss Daly. With the two local piano teachers right down Alexander mm-hmm. Avenue. Mm-hmm. And I remember my mother giving me a dollar bill, that's how much the lesson was, to go down to Miss Daly's house, these were all brownstones here in those days, to take a piano lesson. And I was very young then, I don't know, I was 7 or so, and I was so thrilled because I thought you'd go in, she'd show you how to do it, and you'd walk out and you could do anything. I mean, I thought, you know, then I'd be playing all those wonderful things that people did on the piano, right? Of course, I was heartbroken. You had to work. But with the omnipotence that only a child can have about themselves, I was teed off. I said, what do you mean? I don't want to do that. So I never took piano lessons mm-hmm. when I knew, you know, that it would take more than one session. And it didn't stop me, though, from loving my music. And what happened was that when I went into adolescence and high school and kept singing, I did the Kate Smith show, I remember, on NBC television in 54. I won the Godfrey Talent Scouts in 49 and was on with him a lot mm-hmm. in 49 into 50. Now the voice started then, as I say, to go down. And in 53, I entered Hunter College as a music major. And that's when I got my training for what music was all about. But by singing in choirs, I had taught myself how to sight read. I figured out what the notes meant. And I listened to a lot of music. And what I loved to think about now, too, and I know I made a wonderful impression on a lot of the teachers there in my entrance exams at Hunter, I was already totally in love with classical music, and it didn't necessarily have to be vocal. I was mm-hmm. listening as much as I could to symphonies and concertos and string quartets and piano music. And I, again, sailed through all the entrance exams and dropped the needle stuff. I knew what was going on. And so at Hunter, I really got my basics and my skills in music going that way. And then I sang in the NBC TV opera for Sam Chatsunoff. I sang the Simpleton and Boris Godunov in 50... Help, help, help. It'll come back to me what year we're talking about. I'm just, isn't it funny? I'm trying to, yes, it was around 56 or something when we did that Boris Godunov live for 2 hours or more. And I was more and more in classical music while I was also always singing both the big Irish ballads, all the John McCormick repertoire, and showbiz stuff. Mm-hmm. I used to go with Ben Gross, the columnist on the Daily News, who was a great friend of Dad's. He and his wife, Kathleen Gross, used to take me, I remember very well, to Oscar Hammerstein II's house, little soirees, and I would sing. Hammerstein's office called me up on several occasions throughout several years in my teens, would I like to come and do a real audition to maybe do something on Broadway? And I kind of turned my nose up at it. I wasn't interested in Broadway, even though I loved singing the songs, but I didn't want to, you know. And I didn't do that, but I, as I say,
you preferred the concert stage?
I preferred the concert stage, you know, and I thought opera too in those days. I did get in as a kid. I should point out that I did appear on Broadway in 48 in a play, a musical called Sleepy Hollow with Gil Lamb. And I played Jacob Van Tassel, the leading child's role of those kids up in, you know, up the Hudson Valley there, the Washington Irving novel.
Gil Lamb being the lanky, eccentric dancer comic, right?
That's right. And Betty Jane Watson and Mary McCarty. It was her first Broadway show. So I was in that in June of 48, I remember now. We were at the St. James Theater, or the Majestic. It'll come, because it was either the Majestic or St. James in Boston when we tried out.
We're not going to give a test or points or a quiz or anything. So
Going off, though, at the mouth here about my crazed patchwork career. I'm just thinking, what the heck did I do, and what have I done, and what am I doing?
Well, you've had music as the forefront of your life for all of your life, then.
Absolutely.
And you've made many, many recordings and have performed for a number of presidents and an outstanding, I mean, presidents of the United States and many outstanding artists around the world, haven't you? And you have indeed performed around the world.
I have. I've been everywhere pretty much. I just love it. And what I like too is that I'm still doing it. And I, to this day, I mean, right now I'm on the voice faculty at the Juilliard School. Mm-hmm. I teach voice there. And I'm happy to show the kids that here I am now in my early 60s and the voice is as fresh as ever because I've never done anything to abuse it. And what I have tried to do all the time, though, is to keep learning how to use it. You know, and so challenges come and challenges go, and you develop that way.
Now, when you say you haven't done anything to abuse it, what do you mean?
I mean, I have never tried to sing roles and things that were not right for my voice, or didn't feel, or that I couldn't encompass vocally. So I never got into a situation where I'd get on a stage and be pushing the heck out of the instrument and developing nodes or breaking a vocal cord, which can happen in a little blood spurt, and then you go on voice rest for a month, you know, and all of that stuff. I've never had that, thank God. And so I still sing, and it's still a youthful voice. I just came out this season with a Poulenc recording of the songs of Francis Poulenc. This is the 100th anniversary, 1899, of his birth. And I did it with the late Samuel Sanders, the wonderful pianist that I met when I was 17 and he was 17 at Hunter College. We went through college together. And I did my first recordings for RCA with Sam, with Yo-Yo Ma, and Annie Kavafian. We did the Beethoven folk song settings that are so beautiful, and many other recordings. So virtually the last recording Sam has made is this Poulenc that just came out this year. And I think he did one more recording with someone else right after me. And I have two recordings, and a recording that came out in the past 2 or 3 years with Stephen Huff, who's one of the great concert pianists worldwide, an English pianist. We did beautiful album called Bird Songs at Eventide, where I did the Edwardian ballads. And it goes on and on like that. I've, you know, done modern
things. And you expect
things
to continue.
I'm making a recording of Lowell Lieberman songs. We'll be recording in January for the Arabesque label, which I'm very excited because Lieberman just did the Portrait of Dorian Gray for the Monte Carlo Opera last year, and Chicago Lyric is doing something of his now, and he's really one of the leading classical composers, a very gifted guy that cares about lyricism in song.
Well, you've certainly been a busy person, and look forward to many more years of success with all of this sort of thing.
From your mouth to Godzilla.
Well, thanks very much for the part that you played in the radio days.
Wasn't that a hoot?
That was a wonderful
the show
thing.
The other day.
Well, I mean, when you worked with Fred Allen and you worked with the soap operas and all of these other things, Arthur Godfrey, because I think Godfrey was on radio and TV at that in those
earliest
days. You know.
And I worked with Frank Sinatra and with Bing Crosby. And with, as I said, I think earlier, B. Lilly. I'm just thinking back, all these Burgess Meredith. Goes on and on.
Well, we appreciate very much this chance to have a chat, an opportunity to talk with you.
A joy to talk about it with people as sensitive about what all that means as you. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Robert White.